Hello, this is Al Reynolds with the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I shall share with you the Triangle Business Journal, dated July 6th. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Today's top story above the fold is Wake Company on Path to Add 200 Jobs by Amanda Jones Hoyle from Knightdale. A Wake County electronics manufacturing company based in Zebulon that has grown largely under the radar of publicity is on the verge of a major expansion that could create 200 new jobs over the next 2 years. Electronic Systems Protection Incorporated, or ESP, makes and sells power surge protection devices used on digital machines such as office copiers and professional audio and video equipment. The company also offers devices that can track power consumption and energy usage of such machines. Over the past 4 years, ESP has more than doubled its manufacturing output, as well as the number of people it employs at its Zebulon headquarters, growing from 40 employees to more than 80. ESP could double the size of its workforce again by 2014, bringing in another 100 to 200 people to beef up its manufacturing lines if customer account orders come in as projected, says Dave Perotto, Vice President of Operations, Engineering, and Manufacturing. The company declined to disclose its average wage rate for its employee base, but jobs in similar production occupations in the Raleigh-Cary metropolitan area pay an average salary of $33,330 a year, according to a May 2011 wage estimates report by the Federal Bureau of Labor Statistics. ESP executives are planning to move the company's headquarters and its manufacturing lines from a 30,000-square-foot building at an industrial park in Zebulon to a building nearly three times its size at the East Point campus in Knightdale in the fall. We had to add a second shift, and as that continued in addition to several new product launches, we realized we couldn't do it in this space any longer, Perotto says. The company's president and CEO is Steve Galloway, a former Xerox executive who joined ESP in 2009. Wake County Manager David Cook says it's welcome news for the county. We're always glad to see a Wake County company expanding, Cook says. If they, ESP, are adding jobs, that helps with the tax base of the county. Given the current economic conditions, we'll take every expansion we can get. Much of ESP's rapid growth came about after the sale of the company in 2008 for $82 million to Gridiron Capital, a private equity firm based in Connecticut, and after its merger a year later with SurgeX, another power protection company that moved its operations from Pipersville, Pennsylvania, to Zebulon in 2009. The company, founded in 1985, sells mostly to major copier machine and electronic equipment manufacturers, including Canon and Ricoh, which incorporate ESP devices into the machines sold to their customers. But ESP recently began marketing their products to consumers through websites for Staples and the Home Depot, says Tanya Flores, Director of Marketing for ESP. She estimates the company has close to 20 different product lines of both ESP and SurgeX products and more than 50 stock-keeping units, or SKUs, in production. On the Staples website, the SurgeX products are priced from $150 to $584. All of our product lines are made in Zebulon, and we need more manufacturing lines, she says. Our products are changing. Our customers are changing. We're changing how we distribute our product. Everything about our company is changing. The East Point building on US 64 in Knightdale, where ESP is moving, a former Square D manufacturing facility built in 1972 that Schneider Electric partially vacated in 2003 when it moved some of its production to Mexico. Schneider still occupies about two-thirds of the 274,800-square-foot building, says Ed Brown of the NAI Carolinic Realty real estate firm, who represented the owner of the building in the lease negotiations with ESP. This is a really good story for our market, says Brown. Still on the front page, Towerco could now reload its tower arsenal. By Lauren K. Alsange. From Kerry. With a sale that's bringing in a whopping $1.45 billion, Kerry-based Towerco now may be setting its sights on restocking its inventory of cellular towers with the purchase of 7,000 towers owned by T-Mobile USA. But the asking price could be steep at more than $2 billion. Towerco CEO Richard Byrne doesn't deny such a purchase as a possibility. Buying those towers would be a great way to keep everybody working, and I would love to be able to say we're going to do that. But I don't know, he says that's a pretty tall task. Announced on June 26th was Towerco's sale of more than 3,200 wireless towers to Boca Raton, Florida-based SBA Communications Corporation that Towerco had bought 4 years earlier for $684 million. All of that money, though, doesn't go directly into Towerco's bank account. Investors, including Vulcan Capital and Altpoint Capital, put a total of $740 million in to the Kerry company, and Byrne concedes that an investor exit was the impetus for selling the towers. He declined to disclose the amount that investors would reap from the sale to SBA, nor would he say whether the difference would go toward a T-Mobile purchase. Towerco would, however, have to seek out new investors to cover the difference because the current investors are not interested in a T-Mobile purchase. The proceeds are being distributed, he said, adding that full-time Towerco employees have equity in the company. The T-Mobile package would be a way for the company, whose entire purpose is to own and develop the towers, to survive. Without towers, once the deal closes, which is expected by the end of the third quarter, the company's 77 employees are out of work. This wasn't anybody's preferred outcome, Byrne says of the deal. Precedent exists for Towerco to unload an inventory of towers and then buy another batch. In 2008, the company sold 430 towers to SBA for nearly $200 million, allowing investors an exit. Soon after, the opportunity to purchase more than 3,000 towers popped up, in Byrne's words. But the next time may be more complicated. It's a bigger company now, he says of T-Mobile's towers. Wedbush analyst Suhail Chandy notes that T-Mobile's towers are ready in play, with reported suitors being Boston, Massachusetts-based American Tower Corporation and Pittsburgh-based Crown Castle International Corporation. There could easily be a third horse in the race backed by maybe private equity, Chandy says. No word on what the transaction means for SBA's presence in the Triangle, but Byrne doubts that SBA will set up shop here. It's a more efficient operation if you can centralize it, and they are centralized in Florida, he says. SBA spokesperson Lynn Hopkins says SBA isn't talking details until the deal is closed. Chandy, who calls the transaction fair and beneficial to SBA, says SBA is growing at a rate of 21%, compared to its peer groups at 14%. With the purchase of Towerco's towers, he expects SBA's growth to accelerate to 34%. Towerco was listed as having the fifth largest nationwide portfolio of wireless towers before the sale. This week's lead article on the front page is Money Back Guarantee. With health care reform, millions will flow to employers and employees. By Jason DeBrune from Raleigh. As part of the health reform package that the U.S. Supreme Court left largely intact, health insurance companies will give rebates to some of their clients for the first time this year. In North Carolina, 216,649 health insurance consumers will receive a combined $18.7 million in rebates. Insurers will distribute rebates based on how the premiums were paid, meaning they might be split between employers and employees on company policies. Rebates could come in the form of a check or through credits on future premiums. As part of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, the much-debated health care reform, health insurers must comply with a medical loss ratio, which stipulates that the insurers spend the majority of premiums collected on actual health care as opposed to administrative and other expenses. For group plans, those purchased by employees through an employer, the insurer must spend 85% of premiums on health care, so the MLR is 85%. In the individual market, the MLR is 80%, though North Carolina was granted a one-year reduction to 75% for this year only. Although this is the first year in which insurers give the MLR rebates, the North Carolina Department of Insurance estimates that 58,559 North Carolina residents would have been eligible for $12 million in rebates from health insurance companies if the provision had been enforced last year. The MLR standards help provide greater transparency for consumers about how their health insurance premium dollars are spent, says Wayne Goodwin. He's the state's insurance commissioner. I am pleased that some North Carolinians will receive a rebate and that our health insurance companies are held to high standards. Minnetonka, Minnesota-based United Health Group owes by far the most in rebates in North Carolina. Though its combined United Healthcare groups, the company will rebate $10.6 million, more than half of the total owed here. With 14% of the group insurance market, United is second in North Carolina market share to Chapel Hill-based Blue Cross and Blue Shield of North Carolina, which has a 41% share and does not owe any rebates. In fact, Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina spent $230 million more on medical care than required by the legislation, points out the insurer's CEO, Brad Wilson. Representatives of United Healthcare did not return a request for comment. WellPath Select Incorporated, a division of Bethesda, Maryland-based Coventry Healthcare Incorporated, owes the second highest reimbursement amount in the state at $2.9 million. WellPath CEO Tracy Baker did not respond to an email seeking comment. At a high level, giving money back to consumers is always a good thing, says benefits consultants, especially as many insurers were waiting for the Supreme Court ruling before releasing rebates. This is an unexpected infusion of cash, says Skip Woody, a partner with Raleigh's Hill, Chesson, and Woody, who consults with clients to help them buy insurance. Still, with Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina already controlling so much market share, and the only other company with a more than 6% market share, United, having to pay out the largest amount in rebates, David Crum, president of Raleigh-based employee benefits consulting company, says the law could prompt other insurers to leave the market, reducing competition even more. Crump says some tweaks in how insurers may account for their medical losses might be in order, but in general says the rules get it right. At the end of the day, regardless of what you say about them, Blue Cross Blue Shield of North Carolina, they spend a lot of money on medical bills, and that's the intent. Nationally, 12.8 million Americans will receive $1.1 billion in rebates, or an average of $151 per household. While those don't come out to huge numbers, a health report from Menlo Park, California-based Kaiser Family Foundation says the true savings will be more widely felt in the form of lower premium increases, or in some rare cases, a decrease in premiums this year. That has likely produced some savings for consumers and employers than the rebates themselves, according to the report, which was authored by Cynthia Cox, Larry Levitt, and Gary Claxton. Total spending numbers are staggering as the United States spends upward of $2.6 trillion on health care. At an 80% medical loss ratio, that would mean $520 billion is spent by insurance companies on administrative costs and overhead alone. Moving inside the front page, online MBA is catching fire at NCSU and UNC, by Emily Freeman, from Raleigh. John Willis, a 29-year-old NC State alumnus, just finished his first year at the Jenkins MBA program at the school's Poole College of Management. But Willis has never stepped inside a classroom, nor has he met most of his classmates face-to-face. That's because Willis is doing his two-year MBA studies online. He is a member of the first class of MBA degree hopefuls to participate in NCSU's program, which began in the fall of 2011 with 30 students. To receive his MBA degree in June 2013, Willis must first shell out $37,485 for the two-year 45-credit-hour program. That's a lot of money, but it's a bargain compared to UNC Chapel Hill's online offering, MBA at UNC, which launched last fall with an inaugural class of 19 students. Brian McGrath, a 35-year-old Northwestern University alumni, is going to pay $91,225 for the 24-month MBA at UNC program, $53,740 more for tuition and fees compared to UNCSU. I started the MBA at UNC program when it was brand new, and I had a lot of questions, McGrath says. I came in with skeptical optimism, but after the first quarter, all the skepticism was gone. McGrath currently manages e-commerce for an apparel company in New York City. To put it in perspective, a full-time MBA program, 21 months at UNC, cost about $53,000 for North Carolinians. And at NCSU, a two-year program costs $33,500 for in-state students. The $37,485 NCSU charges its in-state students for its online degree covers textbooks and tuition, but not a week-long immersion trip to China that students are encouraged to attend in May. Current students traveled to Shanghai from May 13th to the 19th to visit global companies, attend guest lectures, and network with their peers. Those who went had to cover an estimated $1,500 in cost once in China, and that did not include airfare and meals. Willis, who has worked for Balfour Beatty PLC for 7 years, was unable to attend the trip to China because his son was born the same week. Still, he says the NCSU program works well with his schedule. Flexibility is key, he says. I'm in the construction industry and work out of Charlotte and Raleigh, so this program allows me to start the classes and see them through, regardless of my work schedule and family life. Cost aside, both schools have received praise from students and staff about the offer of online degrees. McGrath was able to attend his program's March immersion trip to San Francisco, where he met Pandora CEO Joseph Kennedy and participated in a business simulation with his classmates devoted to innovation and entrepreneurial thinking. Unlike the NCSU program, MBA at UNC includes the cost of 4 immersion trips, includes lodging, food, and ground transportation, but not airfare, in its $91,225 tuition cost. Only 2 immersions are required to fulfill the degree. Despite the online curriculum, it was not the first time McGrath interacted with his peers. In fact, he and 14 of his classmates met with a professor every week for a discussion session. We all see each other over webcam and get to interact and discuss what we learned this week. Last quarter, I took a finance course, and the professor actually taught as if she was sitting next to me, he says. As of July 2nd, MBA at UNC had an enrollment of 180 students, while NCSU plans to admit another 28 to 30 students this fall, bringing the program to 60 online MBA students. Although Willis and McGrath attend different MBA programs, they both receive financial support from their employers to cover some of the tuition. McGrath says, "Most everyone is employed that's currently in my program. Fortunately, I work for a company that pays a portion of my tuition, but it ranges. Some companies will pay full tuition, others partial, and others none at all." John Gallagher, Associate Dean for Executive MBA Programs at Duke's Fuqua School of Business, says Duke has not begun the process of designing or delivering a purely online-based program and has no plans to start. Gallagher says he's open to the use of technology in the classroom, but he objects to a purely online approach. Next up, Plotwatt raises $3 million to launch utility software, by Lauren K. Olsons, from Durham. Plotwatt Incorporated is $3 million stronger after closing on a Series A round of equity financing. The money will be used to market the company's utility monitoring software, which is projected to launch later in the summer. The funding round was led by Durham-based Acorn Investments, with participation from seed investor Palo Alto, California-based Facilis Ventures, and Raleigh-based Moorhead Capital. A total of 5 investors participated, according to a securities filing. Founded in 2008, Plotwatt works with both companies and residences to analyze what they're spending on electricity through subscription-based software. A service president and founder, Luke Fishback, claims typically saves customers 10 to 15% on their electric bills. "We've been working hard over the last several months to prove it works really well," he says, adding that since the service is cloud-based, it's relatively cheap for Plotwatt to implement. Other utility monitoring companies exist. Arlington-based Opower, and Palo Alto, California-based Nest among them. But PlotWatt's algorithms differ in that they allow the company to use a single monitor to analyze how much electricity is coming from what appliance. There are several monitoring companies out there, but few go to the device level in a home, says Jason Massey, CEO of Sustainable Industrial Solutions, a sister company to PlotWatt. Those that do often install individual monitors on appliances, Fishback says, adding that PlotWatt systems is 10 times cheaper. By monitoring individual devices, PlotWatt can identify malfunctioning equipment and problem areas, allowing owners to address specific power guzzlers. The company has started working with large national chain restaurants, Fishback says, though he declines to name them and added that the product is still in beta. PlotWatt has grown from 6 employees to 12 over the past year, and that will soon double, Fishback says, by building up the marketing and customer service departments. PlotWatt claims to have more than 1,000 residential and corporate clients, but Fishback would not disclose revenue. The $3 million equity round follows a $1 million seed round in 2011. PlotWatt also netted a $100,000 GE Eco Imagination Challenge grant in 2011 to institute its monitoring software. The company's products will go from beta to full production in the next several weeks, Fishback says. Matthew Winslow, the owner of Raleigh-based Energy Pros of North Carolina, says constant monitoring may not be necessary for residences. His company provides one-time audits that don't cover just electricity. We look at the entire house, everything from the crawl space up to the attic, he says, adding that he analyzes the bills themselves to determine how to save on electricity and offers services he says will save on heating and cooling costs. He says his customers typically don't care about the details and don't need multiple audits. A lot of customers aren't real savvy on kilowatt usage, he says. They just know what the dollars are. And with rising energy costs, he sees the need for the one-time audits increasing. Next up, Coming Home Blues. Military vets face long odds in finding employment. By Lauren K. Alsongs. From Raleigh. As uniformed soldiers return home from duty, they're greeted with patriotic pride in the form of hugs, handshakes, and even perks such as free travel upgrades. As for jobs, not so much. The question, why, is one that puzzles Smith Anderson attorney David Hayden, who sees veteran status as an asset for prospective job candidate. I'm a little bit biased, Hayden says, an Army veteran. I find that reservists and veterans have a lot more experience than some of their peers. His law firm employs 18 veterans or reservists, nearly 10% of the total staff of 220. But data bear out the problem for many vets. In May, 46,000 veterans were unemployed in North Carolina, 11.1% of the total, according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. Compare that to an NC Division of Employment Security report putting general North Carolina unemployment in May at 9.4%. Nationwide, 8.3% of vets had jobs, according to the BLS data. The problem is not among veterans who long ago returned from war or service, but among the younger ones returning from deployments in Iraq, Afghanistan, or elsewhere. BLS data for 2011 show that unemployment among such young male veterans nationally stood at 29.1% compared to 17.6% of non-veterans. That's despite the fact that employers actually can benefit financially by hiring veterans. The VOW, Vow to Hire Heroes Act of 2011, provides a tax credit as of much as $9,600 against a company's Social Security tax for hiring veterans. The credit is available through the end of this year. NC State University economist Steve Allen says veterans network well among themselves, but not so well in circles where they could find jobs. Returning vets have a great military network, but a pretty weak to non-existent informal civilian network, he says. Contacts are so critical in today's market, so this really hurts. At defense contractor U.S. Falcon in Morrisville, 70% of the workforce of 210 is veterans who have completed their active duty service or a reservist. Those still active in the military could be called to duty. While reservists present a different set of issues for employers, they could be called to active duty, leaving a void at her or his employer. U.S. Falcon's Skip Eskridge says his company simply deals with it. He says the company has had multiple servicemen take a year off from their jobs to serve. It's an easy transition back. We've never experienced any problems, he says. Not every employer is so patriotic, says Daryl Johnson, chairman of a Department of Defense committee called the North Carolina Employer Support of the Guard and Reserve. When a soldier can be deployed within 48 hours' notice, it can seem an intimidating hire, he says, adding, leaving for a year or more and then coming back, obviously it's a strain on everybody, he says. But to folks like Hayden, it's a risk. But when they're called up, it's usually for a pretty good reason, he says. What you get in the package of the individual far outweighs that risk. For 40 years, ESGR has acted as both liaison and counsel, encouraging companies to change their policies and educating them regarding the law. It's illegal to fire a deployed soldier, but many employers go beyond the promise of job requirement, even paying the differential in lost salary. And now, wheels begin turning on deals to lease land for drilling. By Chris Bagley. From Sanford. Landowners in central North Carolina are beginning to prepare for what some hope and others doubt will be a natural gas bonanza, even as countless questions remain, especially since Governor Beverly Perdue vetoed a comprehensive fracking bill, only to be overturned by the General Assembly on July 2nd. But the groundwork is being laid out as if all parties agree on fracking in the state. At least three natural gas companies and a local cooperative of landowners have tied up 10,000 acres or more in Lee County, thought to be one of the most promising locations in the state to find natural gas. The goal is to have first claim to drill on the land when and if a new method of gas extraction is allowed to go forward. Denver, Colorado-based Whitmar Exploration Company has leased more than 5,800 acres in Lee County from about 55 landowners since early 2010, according to the county records. Tar Heel Natural Gas LLC of Charlotte has leased at least 940 acres in the county. A third company says it has leased an unspecified number of acres there. And in North Carolina Oil and Gas LLC, a co-op in downtown Sanford has informal agreements to represent the owners of several thousand acres in negotiations with drilling companies, co-owner Randy Covington says. Gas company representatives declined to discuss leases, but Covington says the company's offers have gone from $2 per year per acre in early 2010 to $10 per year per acre in recent months and are likely to go higher. In most cases, the gas companies are obtaining only the rights to gas and other underground compounds, though some of the plots are also being eyed for actual drilling. In contrast to the traditional vertical drilling, gas companies can now drill horizontally for nearly 2 miles from an initial vertical shaft, allowing them to reach gas reserves under the land of owners who have given permission. Hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, another relatively new technique, releases trapped gas when underground rock formations are blasted apart with a mixture of water, sand, ceramic beads, and solvents. A bill passed by the General Assembly over a veto by Perdue directs the state government to begin studying those methods and their potential impacts and to begin developing regulations for them, though the actual green light for drilling would be at least 2 years away. Covington says he believes fracking isn't a question of whether, but when. Now he's telling landowners to wait for better offers. The gas companies have been offering royalties of 12 to 15%, though it's common to go as high as 25%, he says. The purpose of his company is to negotiate favorable lease terms on behalf of all co-op members. The company plans to take a cut, plus 1% or so of what the owners take in, its principals say. The more people that come together, the better the opportunity for the people of North Carolina, Covington says. No one should sign a lease until we have rules and regulations. Covington and his partner, Robert Knight, are involved in the enterprise part-time. Partner Russ Knight works at it full-time. All three own land in the county, either directly or through family trusts. In any case, Covington says fracking isn't likely to start in North Carolina until natural gas prices begin rising again. The sluggish economy, along with new drilling in Pennsylvania, North Dakota, and other states whose reserves probably outweigh North Carolina's, have pulled down prices dramatically. The wellhead price of natural gas fell from $10.79 per 1,000 cubic feet in July of 2008 to $2.25 in March 2012, according to the latest data available from the U.S. Energy Department. North Carolina's gas reserves are believed to be concentrated in the Deep River Basin, a geologic formation underneath an 800,000-acre swath of land that stretches from South Carolina nearly to Virginia. Most of the proven gas reserves are in what's known as the Sanford Subbasin in Lee County, Moore County, and eastern Chatham County. Chevron and various coal companies have hit natural gas there. The Deep River Basin also extends through Durham County and western Wake County. Sanford geologist Russ Patterson says he doubts those areas contain much recoverable gas. That's partly because the rock containing the gas is closer to the surface, where it can escape, says Patterson, who consults for mining companies. Jay Evans of Texas-based Beavers Energy LP says he has begun to lease land in Lee County, but won't say how much or provide any other information. Next up, one advisor suspended as another banned by FINRA, by Lee Weisbecker from Raleigh. Two Triangle-based financial services executives face sanctions following investigations by the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority. Sean K. Hannon of Cary, whose tenure in the industry dates back to 2001, has been barred from any association with a FINRA-registered company. John Herman Flick of Fuquay Varina has been suspended for 18 months and fined $5,000, according to FINRA records. Both men signed consent agreements accepting the FINRA sanctions without admitting any wrongdoing. FINRA made the agreements public in its listing of June disciplinary actions. Hanron allegedly failed to respond to investigators probing allegations of misconduct in two arbitration cases. Those cases began, according to the trade group, when a trio of customers complained that Hanron, then at New York City-based Wall Street E Financial Services Incorporated, or WSE, recommended, quote, unsuitable investments to them, made excessive trades in their accounts, and provided them with false account summaries, end quote. WSC in April 2010 filed a FINRA form saying it had terminated Hannon, but that did not stop the agency's probe of the original customer complaints. On two occasions, in November 2011 and December 2010, FINRA investigators dispatched letters to Hannon asking that he provide testimony or appear at the agency's Florida division office regarding the cases. He failed to do either, says FINRA senior counsel Michael Gross. Hannon's failure to provide testimony has impeded the staff's investigation, Gross says. The trade group's subsequent barring action essentially means that, quote, you are out of the industry, end quote, says FINRA's Michelle Ong. A recording on Hannon's carry phone says an inbox for messages hasn't been set up. Fick faces a suspension that will be in effect from May 2, 2012 through November 6, 2013. Investigators say Fick, who most recently worked with Springfield, Massachusetts-based MML Investor Services, leaving in April 2011, on two separate instances while associated with two different firms, signed customers' names on insurance policies without their consent. FINRA documents, in providing a narrative of disciplinary cases, identify individual customers by their initials. While associated with MML, says FINRA's Washington, D.C.-based counsel Samuel Israel, Fick signed customers J.S.'s names without authorization on an insurance policy delivery receipt and a premium payment form. Fick was scheduled to meet with J.S. the following day to have both documents signed. However, he signed the documents prior to the meeting, says Israel. Fick was terminated by MML when the unauthorized signatures were discovered. Fick did not respond to a request for an interview. It's a waiting game for some banks to exit the TARP program, is this article's title. and it's by Lee Weisbecker. It's from Raleigh. For banks such as Crescent Financial and Yadkin Valley, exiting the TARP program has become a matter of waiting for their names to be called. The U.S. Treasury, in winding down the Troubled Asset Relief Program, has begun auctioning off the preferred shares of stock the bank sold to the government. Raleigh-based Crescent and Yadkin Valley, which owns the Cardinal State franchise in Durham, have filed the necessary paperwork to join in. But so far, the three Treasury auctions held to date have only involved 6 to 7 banks at a time. With 390 banks on the list, the prospect is for a relatively long wait, even with a recent government decision to move to larger auctions. The only North Carolina bank tapped has been Newton-based People's Bank Corp, whose shares went out for auction the week of June 25th. People's, which operates a Raleigh office, borrowed $25 million under TARP. Treasury spokesman Matt Anderson said the results of that sale have not been released. Crescent borrowed $24.9 million under TARP, while Yadkin Valley borrowed $49 million. The banks pay 5% annual interest on the money, a rate that will rise to 9% after 5 years. Crescent is a bank that could exit TARP anytime it wanted, says Raymond James analyst William Wallace. It has plenty of capital. It could simply pay the government back in full to redeem its shares, or it could try to negotiate a discount, he adds. The only reason for remaining on the auction waiting list, Wallace explains, is to try to get a better exit deal. Under the Dutch auctions set up by the Treasury, which are open to multiple bidders, the banks themselves can and are bidding for their own shares, aiming to buy them back at the original sticker price. Beyond that, he says, the banks have the option of approaching whoever buys the auction, wins an auction, to negotiate a buyback. There is game theory going on here, Wallace says. Crescent CFO Terry Early says the bank considers the Treasury auction process to be one of the options for TARP. Treasury hasn't made a decision. We haven't made a decision, he explained, adding that as long as the bank is paying interest of only 5% on the money, it's still pretty attractive capital. More than 66% of Crescent's common shares are owned by Scott Custer-led Piedmont Community Financial of Raleigh. The auctions, which are drawing institutional investor bidders, including the likes of Pittsburgh-based investment shop Wilshire, are also turning out to be a positive for the Treasury. In its second sale, which was held in June and involved 7 banks, Treasury recognized $264 million auction proceeds plus prior interest payments on an original payout of $240 million, according to a Treasury Department release. In its recent move to speed up the wind-down, Treasury officials mailed out letters to 200 smaller TARP banks, explaining that it was considering holding a pooled auction in the fall. Under that arrangement, shares of multiple banks would be sold off at once to a single bid winner. The Dutch auctions allow for multiple winners. Identities of the 200 banks were not released, but SNL Financial's Lindsay White, in a listing of smallest TARP recipients, included 4 North Carolina banks, including Morehead's City Sound Bank, which borrowed $3.2 million from the government. And now, turning electronic trash into cash is a goal of some firms. Entrepreneurs gain support from city and county governments, but also compete with them. By Lauren K. Alsons, from Durham. Plastic shards and metal pieces. To most people, these computer guts are trash. To Mehul Max Patel, president of Durham's American Greens, and others like him, they are money. Local companies and governments alike profit from the skeletal remains of junk that's been banned from landfills since 2011, a broken television, a computer that always crashed. Now old servers can have an afterlife at companies like American Greens, founded in 2009. Hard drives and other storage devices taken to the company go into our computer lab where all the data is replaced or the hard drives are shredded, says Patel, noting such action is the status quo for privacy protection. Patel's company is one of several electronic recyclers in the Triangle that are able to offer their services mostly free because they are paid by some county and city governments for working to assure that such items do not end up as trash. On the back end, the companies generate revenue by breaking down the parts and selling them back to suppliers. After taking hazardous materials out of the electronics, the devices are shredded and the metal is sorted from the plastic. Metals are sorted by type, sold, and smelted. Plastics are processed by plastics companies and repelleted for new manufacturing. Wood and other unusable pieces go to waste management, but very little of it goes back to the environment, and very little of it is paid for by local customers. We don't charge residents in the counties and cities, he says, though there is a charge for pickup and for businesses. Patel works directly with entities such as the town of Garner and the town of Morrisville. Raleigh, Durham, and Chapel Hill, Garner, Cary, Apex, Morrisville, and Fuquay-Varina all have recycling programs or events in place. Cary citizens pay $14 extra on their water bill to accommodate the service. Durham-based Triangle eCycling has been in operation about 3 months and charges individuals $7 to recycle a computer. While it has been profitable, that's only in the strictest sense of the word, founding principal Larry Hurst, a former attorney and business consultant, says he does not refurbish parts but does have them transported to Global Electric Processing for recycling. It's been a struggle, he says, acknowledging that many don't understand why they should pay for recycling when Durham County will dispose of the items for free. He says the cost pays for a guarantee that personal information will be destroyed. Lowell Shaw, Wake County Solid Waste Facilities Manager, says Wake County offers the same guarantee where the information is concerned, wiping hard drives clean. The county has made about $30,000 this year from selling electronic recycling to recycler Synergy, and that money goes towards transporting materials. The program pays for itself, and then some, says Shaw. Not all entities profit. Fuquay-Varina loses money every time it transfers electronic recycling material to Wake County. In July, the town began charging a $10 fee for pickup to compensate. Arthur Mulberry, Fuquay-Varina Director of Public Works, says the cost isn't tracked separately. Next up, Move Would Boost Johnston Revenue by Jason DeBrun from Smithfield. If Johnston Health transfers 50 beds from its hospital in Smithfield to its Clayton Center, as administrators are seeking to do, the amount of revenue generated by those beds would nearly double. State regulators already have approved the transfer of 27 beds from the Johnston Medical Center, JMC, in Smithfield to JMC Clayton. Now leaders of the Johnston Memorial Hospital Authority, more commonly known simply as Johnston Health, have asked the NC Department of Health and Human Services to approve the transfer of 27 additional beds, which would leave JMC Smithfield with 149 beds. The overall project would add 100,000 square feet and two floors to JMC Clayton and cost $20 million. Much of the growth in Johnston County has been in the northwest area around Clayton and Garner, and that's why the beds are needed more in Clayton than in Smithfield, says Johnston Health CEO Chuck Elliott. The move has been significant in financial implications as well. Last year, JMC Smithfield reported $1.4 million in operating income and $120 million in net patient service revenue. That factors out to revenue of $623,000 per bed, or net income of $7,019 per bed for JMC Smithfield's existing 199 beds. In financial projections for JMC Clayton, the hospital shows it would record $5.4 million in operating revenue and $61 million in net patient revenue by the third year after the beds are transferred. For the 50-bed hospital, it comes out to a revenue of $1.22 million or net income of $108,000 per bed. To be sure, hospitals generate revenue from more than just the medical beds, and JMC Smithfield includes 20 behavioral health beds, which traditionally generate lower income and revenue rates. In point of fact, though, acute care beds make up the backbone of a hospital system's financials. Johnston Health received initial approval to help JMC Clayton in 2007. It opened in 2009 with an emergency department and outpatient services, but inpatient services, for the acute care beds are required, were saved for later. In 2008, Johnston Health received approval to move 27 beds from Smithfield to Clayton, with plans to complete that project in 2013 and 2014. If approved for 23 beds on top of those 27, the expanded project would happen at the same time. The decision to grow JMC Clayton is fairly straightforward, says Elliot and Jackie Ring, JMC's Clayton's chief operating officer. Johnston County, particularly in the northwest region that includes Clayton, is experiencing explosive growth and development, Elliot says. About 60% of patients who go to the JMC Clayton Emergency Department and need to be transferred to a hospital go to JMC Smithfield. The other 40% go to hospitals in Wake County, Ring says. Establishing inpatient services to Clayton, therefore, simply makes sense. Well, that's what healthcare has to do, says Don Dalton with the North Carolina Hospital Associations. We have to be where the patients are. This week's legal focus is from Jim Verdonik. Mr. Verdonik is an attorney with Ward and Smith, PA, in Raleigh. This week's article is titled, Applying Well-Worn American Values to Your Enterprise. Jefferson's immortal phrase, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, can have many meanings. With July 4th just passed, do you ever wonder whether you and your business are measuring up to your heritage? What would America's founders think about your business? Specifically, are you promoting life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness in your business? Can you do that? Should you do that? Why would you do that? How would you do that? Doesn't that just apply to the government? All are fair questions. Let's start answering them by agreeing with a basic premise. Thomas Jefferson wasn't just describing governmental systems when he wrote Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness. Jefferson was expressing universal values in the American colonies ingrained in the population. Back when you learned about fractions, you probably searched for the least common denominator a million times. Jefferson's Life, Liberty, and Pursuit of Happiness is the American least common denominator. We might not all agree what these words mean, but we all value them. So let's solve for the American least common denominator in your business. I assume your business is promoting your own life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. If not, why are you working so hard? Chill out and drink a beer at the beach until you figure out why you aren't doing that. And don't come back to work from the beach until you have a plan for your business to promote your life, your liberty, and your pursuit of happiness. That's the easy part. Next are your customers. Are you helping your customers promote their life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness? If not, you are risking your business. If you aren't helping your customers promote their lives, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, your competitors will. So keep drinking beer at the beach until you figure out how to deliver more life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness to your customers. If you spotted a pattern here, congratulations. Reward yourself. Open another beer and apply sunscreen. Now we get to the difficult part. What about your employees? Don't they deserve life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness? Won't your business be a better place if work helps them? One might be tempted to ask, why should my business help my employees with their life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness? Isn't paying them enough? Paying your employees is the minimum you have to do to comply with the law. When did you start operating your business on the principle that doing only what the government requires is the way to be successful? Is that working for you? So the answer to why is, if your employees don't have life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness at work, why will they help your customers with their life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness? And if your customers aren't getting life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness from your business, then we know you won't be getting life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness from it either. I guess you might say that's circular logic. It's not supposed to work, except when it does, especially after a few beers at the beach. So the first thing you do when you get back from the beach, right after you recycle all those beer bottles, is take all those employment policies your lawyers made you adopt and review each one with the least common denominator in mind. How does this policy promote my employees' life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness? You'll be glad you did. Happy Independence Day. This week's guest column is from Brian Balfour. Mr. Balfour is Director of Policy at the Civitas Institute in Raleigh. Titled, How North Carolina Can Boost Growth. North Carolina can improve its dismal 9.4% unemployment rate, the fourth worst in the nation. We can learn from states with the highest rate of sustainable, growing businesses and robust business creation. North Carolina is in need of several policy reforms that involve these two key areas, encouraging business startups and enabling sustainable companies. Businesses that thrive are aligned with consumer preferences. North Carolina distorts the entrepreneurial response to consumer demand by offering targeted tax breaks and taxpayer subsidies under the guise of economic development. Such government-granted privileges encourage businesses that otherwise would not exist if they were left to play by the same rules as others. By responding, at least in part, to state economic development programs, entrepreneurs are no longer making decisions based solely on profit opportunities. By being exempted from an expense paid by most other businesses, i.e. taxes, privileged businesses can pay more for resources and bid up their price. This increases the cost of doing business for others, forcing some to downsize or cease operations. The result is a greater share of North Carolina businesses not aligned with true consumer preferences, but rather propped up courtesy of political favors. That's not a recipe for increasing sustainable businesses. What stands in the way of more business formations in the state? The simple answer is this: incentives matter. When entrepreneurs evaluate whether to start a business, a significant part of their decision rests on the after-tax return on investment. But we have the highest top marginal income tax rate in the region and 11th highest nationally. A higher tax rate means a lower return on investment. Because capital is mobile, entrepreneurs will decide the return is insufficient here and will open a shop elsewhere. Moreover, less mobile resources, including low-skilled workers, are stuck in a poor-performing state with fewer job opportunities because entrepreneurs are fleeing for greener pastures. The time is right for North Carolina to tear down barriers to growth. Eliminating government privileges will help ensure more businesses enjoy sustainable access, and lower tax rates will encourage business creation. That would be a great start. 6 months from now, North Carolina will have a new governor and many new legislatures. All will promise to have the answers to solving our economic woes, but how many of them will be wise and bold enough to remove the political obstacles to sustainable, healthy economic growth? Also, this week's guest column is by Mr. David Moff. Mr. Moff, SPHR, is Chief Executive Officer of the HR Group, a North Carolina human resource consulting, recruiting, and training firm based in Greensboro. Are you ready for the talent rush? A talent rush is underway because the economy is getting better, but not as fast as we would like, but it's getting better. The impact on employers and employees warrants attention. For employees, the job market's improving means companies are hiring. That means this talent rush has real ramifications, especially for employers fiercely competing for the most talented job candidates. Right now, and certainly through the presidential election in November, economic news across all media will be pervasive, and it will fuel the talent rush. Fortunately, business leaders can see past the daily ups and downs to the longer-term upward trend that is occurring. For HR professionals, it means hiring will accelerate. But will they hire the right people? For the talent class, it means opportunity. Smart employers are engaging proactive recruiters to help find the right people. Often, this proactive method involves contacting talented, skilled people currently employed at other businesses and luring them with better and more challenging positions and opportunities. Talent class employees are attractive. They enjoy a strong position to seek and accept more challenging and rewarding jobs, probably elsewhere, unless their current employers act to retain them. Employers need to be aware of this natural phenomenon. While cheering positive news, employers always need to be aware of the risks and challenges of hiring, especially if they reduced workforces and need to hire again. Here's where an HR maxim comes into play. The way you acted in bad economic times will dictate how successful you will be in better times, as the hiring pendulum is swinging back. Challenge 1. Can you retain your talented employees? Challenge 2. Finding the right people. As you ramp up hiring, there are several questions to consider. How do you really know if you're hiring the right people? Should you rehire people you laid off? Are former employees the right cultural fit now? Hiring the right people requires careful thought, not reckless expediency as in giving a job to a friend or a relative because they are good people. Instead, invest the time to find the best person possible. Be clear about the role you seek to fill. Speed is not the goal in hiring. The right fit is. Turnover is costly. Use available tools. Many hiring managers erroneously believe they can pick the winners by trusting their gut instincts. Gut feelings may play a part, but research indicates a 1 in 7 chance of hiring the right person based solely on the interview. Challenge 3. Replace employees who should go. We all make mistakes. Hurried employers make bad hires, and hasty job candidates make bad decisions about offers they accept. Challenge 4. Recognize that the talent pool is shifting as new skills are demanded. The changing economy requires employer flexibility and adaptability for new skills required. If not, companies will lose the competitive edge and can easily be modern dinosaurs in the technology age. We've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. We hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. I'm Al Reynolds, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This episode of the TBJ will be available for download from the TRRS website momentarily. The web address is trianglereadingservice.org. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. So long until next time.